Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is part 3 of episode 8. For more information about the whole episode and to get the readings, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to the previous part, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion. And now, back to the conversation.
Where we finished up, we had finished talking off about parts 1, 2, and 3 of Chester Bernard's The Functions of the Executive. And in part 3, we had just recently talked about cooperative systems and incentives. And Bernard talks a lot about the fact that material incentives are not sufficient. And then he begins to address the system of communication in part 3. And so part 4, what we're going to go into is how the communication system works and the real role of executives. So you can think of parts 1, 2, and 3 of the book as setting up part 4, where he really now gets into the functions of executive work and why that is so important to organization functioning. He starts out in part 4 talking about the executive functions. And one of the things I think is most interesting and crucial to Bernard's understanding of the role of executives, he talks about executives occupying centers or points of interconnection in the system of communication. So he's already laid out why the system of communication exists, and now he starts addressing the role that executives play in maintaining that. And in fact, distinguishes that from other executive activities to say that's one of the primary functions of the executive.
This is an interesting bit, and there he says something that's possibly slightly counterintuitive to how we understand what executives do. Because at the bottom of page 216, he says that executive functions serve to maintain a system of cooperative effort, which is what we discussed previously. Then he adds that they are impersonal. And then he says that the functions are not, as so frequently stated, to manage a group of persons. And then goes on to, it is not even quite correct to say that the executive functions are to manage the system of cooperative efforts. As a whole, it is managed by itself, not by the executive organization, which is a part of it. The functions with which we are concerned are like those of a nervous system, and then proceeds to give an analogy of the brain in relation to the rest of the body. So executives don't manage people.
Right. So I think there's two things in there that are profound. This idea that executives don't manage people, like you said, I think that's amazing because of it comes from Bernard's understanding of how organizations work and how the work gets done through cooperative systems. And I think the other thing that's amazing, and I think it's a corollary, it works in tandem with this, is that it largely manages itself. That's just amazing to me, that a guy who's talking about organizations and how executives function in them, he's not using the machine metaphor that we've seen in other writers of this time. He's basically saying you set up the machine, but then it runs. It's almost like he's thinking of an organization like what you guys would call a football club, where once the coach has kind of set up the system that the players play in, then they run everything, and the coach really can't direct the game. In contrast to many American sports, where the coach is in charge of everything going on and calls all the plays and everything. I think it's a really interesting approach to organizations that it's counter to a lot of the writing that we've seen thus far.
Right, so the executive is not to micromanage, essentially.
Yes.
And then he proceeds to say what executives are supposed to be doing, and that is, one, to provide a system of communication, two, to promote the securing of essential efforts, and three, to formulate and define purpose. So we talked about communication, and that has to do, of course, also with authority. The securing of essential efforts is something akin to selecting and hiring personnel. And formulate and define purpose is presumably something to do with the strategic direction of the organization.
Did you also notice that at the beginning of the chapter, Bernard mentions the fact that executives do a considerable amount of work, of non-executive work, and this work is, he actually says, it's more valuable than the executive work. So it's also kind of like expanding the role of the executive and saying that it could be pretty unique depending on the type of organization and the situation.
Yeah, he's got a line on 215, which I think comes close, and because I didn't quite get quite the part Miranda. I think it's a great observation Miranda had. I didn't write that down, but he has a part where he says, executive work is not that of the organization, but the specialized work of maintaining the organization in operation. And then I think Miranda just carried it a little further in that there's these other things they do that's very important to what executives can accomplish in organizations. Because I think we have this current view of management that executives do a lot of stuff, you know, and it's certainly that's the hiring and firing and, interpreting reports and stuff. And here's a guy who's saying that's not really the most important work they do. And I think that's the observation Miranda was making, or the quote she was bringing up, which I think is very interesting. And a comment I wanted to make about when Demetrius talked about the essential executive functions, particularly that first one, we talk about provide the system of communication. I think in a lot of organizations, and certainly in my experience, this has been the case, you come in the organization and they already have a system of communication that may or may not be very easy to change. And certainly organizations it's not common for them to say, oh yeah, come on in and just change all the ways, you know, that we communicate. And I've come in at very senior levels before, and that's been one of my observations, is that it's not easy to change if the system of communication, even if it's not working very well. And I think that you have a lot of latitude when you're designing an organization at the beginning. Not many people have that experience. But the example I wanted to give, it's actually kind of famous in the U.S. Navy and in some areas of management science, and that's the Naval Reactors Organization that Hyman Rickover set up after World War II to design, produce, sustain, and dispose of nuclear reactors for ship propulsion. One of the things he gave a great deal of thought to was the system of communications that they used. And he set it up so that he could actually monitor what all the executives were doing. You had to actually, as you were doing work, you had to type rough drafts of memos. And you had to, back in those days, you had to use carbon paper. And he had these, the carbon paper actually used tissues behind the carbon so that it was easier for the typewriter to, or whatever you were writing with, to make the copies. And so he had this very elaborate system of communication where the different colors of the carbons that were made, or the copies that were made, were to have different purposes. And so even today in naval reactors, people will talk about pinks and greens as if those pieces of paper were still being used, and they're not. it's a holdover from that system of communication. So they talk about them, but they don't use the colors anymore, because now everybody has, you can make as many copies as you want, and it's all, you know, white paper and that sort of thing. But I think that is a profound insight that's such an important function of the executive.
That is so interesting. What does it mean, the pinks and the greens?
Okay, so what he used to do is you would have your secretary, if you were working on a memo to some supplier organization or some direction to somebody out in the field, you had to make a copy. I guess they would type on regular white paper. But behind that, though, would be a green tissue, a yellow tissue, and a pink tissue. And I forget what the yellows were, but the greens was the copy you got to keep. And you would keep these on clipboards outside your office. And the pink was the copy for Admiral Rickover himself. And he would send a secretary or administrative person around to all the offices every day to pick up the clipboards that had the pink copies on them. And then that way he could monitor all your correspondence, what you were getting ready to do, what your agendas were, all those kinds of things. And there's actually a case in a book written by somebody who used to work for him, Theodore Rockwell. He's written many books about naval reactors. And he's talked about an executive getting called on the carpet by Rickover because he wasn't seeing many pinks in the office, and he knew the guy was working on stuff, and called Rickover called him to his office and said, why aren't you doing this? Why? And because I can't keep track of what you're doing and follow through. Rickover used to read all of these things, and the organization in those days was small enough that he could keep his fingers on everything that was going on. Now, he was a lot more actively engaged in many respects than some of the things that Bernard talks about, because Rickover didn't believe organizations run themselves. But this, the thought he put into the system of communication was just amazing, and you just don't see that in modern offices.
Huh. Would that qualify as a system of communication, Bernard's sense, though? Because this is more like system of accountability.
Well, it's both, right? I mean, so it functions on many levels and also gave Rickover the ability to micromanage in the details, right? So I'm not saying he was a complete student of Bernard, although I would be surprised if he wasn't aware of him because he was very widely read. But it also served as a formal system of communication that managed how people were kept informed of what was going on in the organization.
Because this is somehow akin to using email tracking and other sort of these panoptical forms of management control, though.
Yes. I would say it's similar. I mean, you can use these in you know, all sorts of ways. So just because you know what an office is doing doesn't mean you have to intervene. But Rickover could give comments on the correspondence or, you know, those kinds of things. And because remember, they were setting up a brand new organization that had never existed before doing what they were doing. And therefore, Rickover gave a lot of thought to how he was going to manage that organization. And he'd worked in the bureaucracy of the Navy during World War II. So apparently he had lots of ideas about how this stuff would be set up. But I've actually asked people, it's not written, I can't find a place where it was written down, actually, how the system worked. You have to just talk to people who functioned in it, and they could tell you how it worked.
I suppose, no, I'm not disputing this, but I suppose what I'm kind of trying to hint at is that this isn't, right, so people don't have to communicate this way.
So it can be used. It can be used for control as well, and it was. All I'm saying is I'm divorcing the control aspect that Rickover used it for, and saying he designed a very elaborate system of communication that wasn't just for him to control. Because I think some of the other copies were designed to be routed to other offices, so the other offices could see what other people were working on. Because back in those days, people weren't sending email constantly, and so the load of administrative, you know, paperwork was much lower than it is today. And I think it's less feasible today to do stuff like that, because now today we do CCs of everybody and you get 1,000 emails in your inbox every day and it becomes unmanageable. So we've had this kind of proliferation of the tool. So I agree, it can be used for multiple things. I was just focusing on the fact that it was this very detailed system of communication that he set up.
And that's fine. Perhaps my understanding of system of communication is more to do with division of labor than with something as literal as mediums for communication. So when I read Bernard saying that the function of the executive is to, what's the word he used? Maintain?
Provide the system of communication.
Yeah, provide system of communication. Yeah. To me, that resonated more with things like hierarchy and accessibility of individuals and data, and even going as basic as access control, so where you can and cannot go. So that is probably due to my work in organizational memory where I got swayed to. But I do love your example. It's really interesting.
Yeah, thank you. And I think your understanding is a good one, and I just think it's the way Bernard writes it, I think it's general enough. He writes it generally enough that it can also include those more specific things that I was talking about. Because it also would include, well, in the hierarchy, who do you ask for what kinds of things and under what circumstances? Who has permission, you know, for this or that kind of thing? Because a lot of times a lot of times not written down. So you have to figure out, that's one of the most challenging things when you go into an organization, is trying to learn the system of communication, both in formal and informal, because the vast majority of the communication, I believe, is informal, but it still has rules that you have to follow. And so I've come into many organizations where it's very challenging to figure that out. So I'll give you another example. When I worked in one organization, you could go to a meeting and you'd have this kind of formal communication of the hierarchy and you know, here's who's in charge and here's what we're going to do, and you would brief the plan. So a lot of that stuff, those aspects you were talking about, and then you'd find out, you'd walk out of the meeting and you'd find out not only people in the room, but people who work for the people in the room, weren't following the plan. And they didn't, I can't say what they were thinking, but it didn't appear they felt any obligation to come back and tell you they weren't going to follow the plan. You had to discover this on your own by either somebody telling you or going out and seeing they weren't following the plan. And I found out later that's not by briefing leadership and senior leaders about the plan isn't the way you got things done in that organization. You actually had to brief the people below them that made stuff happen first. And then they would give you feedback about whether they thought the plan would work or not. And then when you briefed the plan, it was something that they had largely agreed with. But the normal kind of top-down approach that I'd seen work at other organizations didn't work at all in this organization.
Yeah. Well, I found a place where Bernard says what he means by communication. So let's see how that applies to your examples. It's page 218. He says, in other words, communication, position, and the locating of the services of a person are complementary phases of the same thing. The center of communication is the organization's service of a person at a place.
Oh, I think it's clear, but I just said when he says communication, you can read all sorts of stuff into what that means, right? So go back to your first part of the sentence, and he talks about communication, and then he talks about some specific aspects of it. And I don't think it's unclear. I just say there's more to it than that.
Can I add something just to add to a bit of confusion? So my reading of this part was that communication equals a person. Like, I saw it very much grounded within the person. It is true, just to add a small thing, that we have to contextualize it when it was written. So a lot of concepts that maybe we have today on communication are quite different because we've got another sense of the technology and the means that we can use to communicate. I'm not sure if I'm helping.
Well, he's talking about the center of communication, and I also wrote that down as well, that he said executives occupy centers or points of interconnection in a system of communication. So I get that, right? So I think there's two different things he's talking about or can be interpreted from that, but maybe not that one directly, but he has talked about communication earlier in the book. So at one level, you're talking about the nodes of communication, right? These center points or these points of interconnection, much like the ladder stuff that Fayol was talking about. But then there's also the aspect of what gets communicated, you know, and how things are being communicated, which is part of that formal system. It's not just the person itself. It's also what information is getting transmitted. And so I can't think of a specific reference this minute, but it's early in the book when he talks about that. And he talks later, and we'll get to this in the chapter, so maybe just bear with me for a little while. I'll be able to show you. He talks later about informal communications, and he gives kind of very specific examples of things that have to go informally, which is why I think it means both the system that's in place and actually what gets communicated. So we'll see. We'll keep talking about this and we'll see if I'm able to make myself clear. Because you would say, well, he's really just talking about the executives and the positions they occupy. But I think he's addressed that earlier in the book. And if I get a chance, I'll go back and take a look and see why I think that. But I think it'll come a little clearer as we go on.
Right. Just one thing before we depart from this. Is he also covers organizational change in the same area, saying that it starts with men are neither good nor bad, but only good or bad in this or that position. This is why they not infrequently change the organization. The arrangement of positions, if men suitable to fill them, are not available. So organizational change is primarily to do with where people are, what they do.
Yeah, so one of the things I think that's a great point to bring up because that was actually the very next place I was going to go. And he goes on to talk about fitness, right? So we can talk about that in a minute. But I think that's a tremendous insight, right? That the judging whether a person is successful or good or bad in Bernard's terms in the position is not just his or her say innate capabilities or just skills and weaknesses. It's those things matched with the position. And so I think that's really interesting because we have a guy here writing in the 30s about sort of fitness or fit in the position, which I think is an amazing insight.
Well, this is reminiscent of what Taylor wrote as well. Remember he had those experiments with women sorting bicycle balls or something like that. There was a
ball bearings. Yeah,
so there was a lot about fitness to position, and albeit in a different way, but seems to have been a consistent theme within the. Well, actually, kind of taking a slightly darker turn, eugenics is also fitness for position, isn't it?
It can be interpreted that way. Absolutely.
So might have been the.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I'm glad you brought up the Taylor reference, because he talk about the sorting of the ball bearings or the sorting process, but he talks about somebody being the first class man, right? In other words, well suited to the position. And it was Taylor's view that, and he wrote in the book that if a person didn't have the right fit for the position, or whether they weren't strong enough or couldn't go fast enough or what have you, that they should be moved to another position where they were more functional, right? So you're right to point out that Taylor first addressed that. So it's not new for Bernard to say it, but I like the fact that he comes right out though and says you're neither good nor bad. It's just how. And I've seen that in the working world, where you'd see people don't do well in some particular position. So then you try to move them to some place where you can see their skill sets might match better, and they flourish in those positions. It's very satisfying to see that as an executive, somebody who wasn't doing very well, then get because they were not well matched for the position, and then it goes. It's also related to your more darker view of the Peter principle, which does say that sometimes people get in positions where they're not suited. What I would say is that sometimes people are put in positions where they don't grow into the position, right? Because many positions require different skill sets, and very few people are uniquely suited initially to fill that skill set or have that skill set or thrive in those positions. So sometimes it's a combination of learning. It's maybe developing parts that they didn't know they had. It could be formal schooling. And some people never kind of gel in the position. And I think there's been management texts written about the chaos that's created when you leave somebody in a position for which they're not suited for too long, the damage it does to an organization. But I'm probably digressing a bit here. So after that, he talks about that the fitness part, which I thought was he made some really interesting observations about that. Then he talks about the most important single contribution, which I think is a bit controversial in my mind. Really want to see what you guys think. Most important single contribution required of the executive is loyalty to the organization. That's on page 220. And then he goes on later in 220. He lists some other ones like loyalty, responsibility, what I would call putting the organization needs above the personal. He has another way of saying that, but I think that's what it comes, what it means. And I think it might be like Miranda was talking about, what sort of a man of his time, where maybe they didn't have to think about ethics and personal integrity, but you see many kind of shocking examples of either white collar crime or basically corruption or chaos in organizations caused by people who were very loyal to the organization, but above all else, and then certain malfeasance came because they held the organization up higher than anything else, and unethical behavior can result. So to me, that's sort of a red flag for me, because I think that can be taken too far. If that really is the single greatest contribution, your loyalty to the organization outweighs your feelings of ethics. I think that's kind of risky, because there's times when organizational goals come into conflict with ethics.
Well, he defines loyalty as domination by the organization personality. So I think it's more right. To do with, as an executive, you need to be so in tune with the strategic direction and the purpose of the organization that you're managing that you sort of become it in a way.
And I think you can do that in a good way, but I also think there's a darker side of that, that you can do that in a bad way, where you... So for example, here's an example. So if it makes sense for the organization's purpose to build an oil refinery I'm not talking about pollution, right? But build an oil refinery in a poor people's neighborhood and displace a lot of people, or in the case of China and the Three Gorges Dam, all the communities that were displaced as a result of that, you might not factor in other considerations like the quality of life or other people's interests, and because you're so focused on the organization. I'm not saying what he said is wrong. I'm just saying there could we've seen in modern times there's a dark side to that.
No, I was just gonna observe that if there's something with the entire work by Bernard, it's that we always need to give a precise definition of certain concepts that are used that we may interpret in light of our common everyday vocabulary and language, but that also, depending on the parts of the work, may assume different meanings. So loyalty, I think, is, from what I interpreted it, is this idea of being a unique entity with the organization. So basically devoting your entire time to the organization, being corresponding to it, having a complete overlap of goals and so on. So the individual loses its personal identity, individual personality. And I don't know, I think it's quite worrying. I wasn't too comfortable with this
well, and
idea.
That was my point.
Yeah,
that's my point. Yeah. You can take that to a dark place. I don't necessarily think that's what Bernard intended or what he was trying to explain. But I was just saying, and so I'm not criticizing him for that per se. I'm just saying, in light of sort of our modern understanding of those kinds of things and what conflicts come into place, that's something that you do have to be aware of. I think that's really what I was trying to say.
No, and you have a point, and it is, it works with his system.
Yeah, so I think it works well together when he talks about, because Miranda gave a very nice definition, and I think her point was excellent about, you know, we have to kind of interpret the specific terms he's using that he often defines, most of the time he defines, and so you have to be aware of that. And then I was just making this other observation that you do have to be careful with some of those things, because we are, our modern understanding of loyalty, and he's not even, because nowhere in this top four list does he talk about ethics and kind of social responsibility, which now we believe are very important attributes of an executive.
Well, the entire next chapter is basically on morality, so that supplements these. But yeah, he is, in terms of his terminology, he's like baby Kant of organization studies. There's so much here that is based on precise definitions that are not always given and that are frequently counterintuitive, because he's appropriating regular words to mean something that wouldn't normally be understood by them. So there's this semantic manipulation going on.
Yeah, he's got very specific definitions for some of these things that are not always what you would think they mean. I agree with you. And that's a great summary, sort of a baby Kant. That's a great summary of some of the, you know, challenges with interpreting.
Right. And there's one thing that's sort of that I find perplexing, because on the one hand, throughout the entire book, Bernard speaks of an organization in terms of a system, that it's a system of cooperation, a system of responsibility, those things that even leadership is considered as a systemic matter rather than a personal trait or property. And then at the same time, in parallel, he says things like organizations are separate entities in the world, and not in a legal way, but in this existential way, that once people come in and become phases of cooperation, as we discussed previously, an organization is born as a thing in itself. And then here, similarly, he says this thing about organization's personality, that it needs to be plugged in by the executive into.
Yeah, the executive needs to connect into that as a sort of a living thing. I agree. I think it has lots of implications for that, because it certainly has a lot to do with this, the maintaining the system of cooperation and incentives and those kinds of things. And I think it's the insight is important. And that's why I'm not really criticizing what he was saying. I was just thinking it's something to be aware of.
True. But the thing is that this duality that is going on between the systems and this almost metaphorically organic being is making me a bit uneasy.
Yeah, I think it makes it a challenge to interpret what he's saying for the reasons you just said.
Yes. So where does organizational personality come from? Is it, again, and I surfaced this in part one of episode 8, that where is this a personality aggregate of the organization? Is it something to do with the senior management team? Is it the perception of the organization from the outside? Come on, Bernard, give us some detail.
Yeah.
You can't just throw out a thing like organization's personality, and this is the key function of the executive, is to be in tune with that, and kind of leave it at saying that it's basically a responsibility or regularity or complete submission if you're in a religious organization.
Yeah, I agree. That was very unsatisfying.
So when you were executiving around, yes, have you ever appropriated the personality of the organization that you were leading?
You mean internalized it myself?
Well, I don't know. It depends, I suppose, on how you interpret this.
So the answer is yes. If you're talking about this, and it's actually it's a fascinating point that he talks about, this organizational personality, because what I noticed in my Navy time, but also in other positions as well, is that organizations do have personalities, and it's not always obvious, you know, when you go through either a job hiring prospect or you read about the organization, to know what that is. You actually have to function organization to interpret it or pick it up, and you get it indirectly from people. I used to take the time to actually write it down so I could understand it better, and, you know, because it's painful to bump into the organizational personality and have conflicts, as this Bernard talks about in the fit aspect. So I'll give you an example. We'd have, when you're doing work on Navy ships, and, you know, it's complex, it's highly skilled, it's very difficult, it can be time consuming, it's very expensive. So there are some expressions that we I don't want to say we banish, but they're, you know, disapproved of. And if you start using them, you'll get talked to by somebody, or you'll have a difficult conversation. So the example would be, well, as far as I know, right? That's a very common conversational term. Somebody will ask you, Ralph, what's this? And you can say, well, as far as I know, they're not going to do this. That's forbidden, or it's frowned upon, but you don't get it directly. So people say, no, I want to know, how do you know that? Who did you talk to, and what did they say? And then the people, when people say as far as they know, what I've learned is they tend to be masking vagueness. They don't really know. And then you say, okay, well, if you don't know, then, you know, stop guessing, and then go find out. And you get people to be much more precise and specific in their communications. That's just a very small example of that kind of language. And so I would, if I heard people using it, I'd actually tell them explicitly, but quietly. I wouldn't tell them, you know, in a group of people. I'd pull them aside and say, look, you can't use language like that. Either you know or you don't. And if you don't know, don't speculate on what you don't know. And so the modern manifestation of that, and I think all of our listeners will be able to sympathize with this. If you've ever called a help desk for some computer or operating system, and you're having some specific problem, you can't do the thing, get the machine or software program to do X, and then the person will suggest a couple things and they won't work. You know, sometimes, I mean, sometimes it works, but so I'm talking about the more complex ones, and they don't work. And then they start making up reasons. And I can tell it right away, because I'm attuned to listen to this. They start making up reasons why they think it might be the case. And so for example, I was talking to this person. They said, well, you know, it's supposed to update right away, but, you know, servers could be overloaded, and it could be taking longer, you know. And so I tune into that like a laser beam. So what that tells me immediately, I try not to be insulting to people, but what tells me immediately is they don't know. And so they're just guessing. And so I find that very frustrating, coming from my, you know, the systems of communication I've been in. I find that and organizational personalities, I find that very frustrating, because I tend to be very precise. I'll tell you if I don't know. That's one of these things that's not usually written in an organizational book, and you have to pick up inside there. So that's kind of an organizational personality aspect. But apparently, this idea about not wanting to admit you're either wrong or don't know, or it gets at professional pride and personal concepts of efficacy. And so apparently that's hard for people to do. And that's part of the socialization of the – you have to kind of match people, you know, to the – help them fit in the organization. That's one of these big challenges of organizational life, is a lot of the rules aren't really written down. So there's this kind of personality aspect of it. And so what I also noticed in the Navy is that some organizations, different organizations, had different personalities. So the parts of the organization could have different personalities based on their commanding officer or the CEO, but there's some of the core stuff would be the same. So I'll give you another example. There was I was working with a separate organization. So I wasn't the organization I was working for, but I was had this liaison support function for this other organization. And what I noticed very quickly, it wasn't with my dealings, it was at the working level, the people who were reported to me, they would be in a meeting with this other people from this other organization, and when something they were asking for something that was impossible, you know, we're not talking difficult to do, but nearly impossible, you know, my people would say, well, that's not how it's done, or this is, it's difficult in this way. The people in the other organization basically made it, went as quickly as possible to get that to their senior leader so that he could come over and start, heaping wrath. And so I found out that when my people were, they thought they were being helpful, saying, no, we can't do it this way, or this is how it happened. I told them, I said, look, from now on, since all of this stuff comes back, anytime you say no to them, they're not going to even converse with you about it. All they wanted, they have a very efficient system for getting that information back to their CEO, and then basically lightning bolts coming. So I said, anytime you're going to say no, you have to actually get my permission first, because I have to be able to distinguish between, okay, that's difficult to do and we'll have to do quite a bit of effort, sort of as the Japanese say, you know, it will be difficult, and something that's actually physically impossible or against the law. Because if it's feasible to do, you don't get to say no. I'm going to be the one who has to say no, because I'm going to suffer the consequences anyway. So I had to actually modify my system of communication for this other organization. And I just thought that was amazing. I was watching how that communication worked. It was very interesting.
That is amazing. I feel that I have to ask, and I'm pretty sure that this is on the minds of many of our listeners. So the things that you described about organizational personality, they sound a lot like organizational culture.
Yes, that's sort of the easy way to describe it. But there's, to me, what I noticed was organizations have multiple cultures, as you would expect. There's sort of this differentiated culture and organization. So there is a culture that tends to be common across the organization, and then there's differences within units because of the who's in charge and kind of what their rules are. And so I'll give an example. So I was on a Navy ship and had this pretty good working relationship with my boss, and I could come up with ideas and suggestions for things we could go do, and we could have a kind of free exchange with that. And so then I was talking to one of my peers in another department, and he was very hesitant to accept any kind of new idea. And I finally asked him, I said, why do you respond to that, you know, this sort of negative way every time we come up with something new? I mean, I'm just trying to understand, am I asking for dumb things, or, you know, do you think that none of this stuff is possible? He said, no, that isn't really the issue, because I was good friends with him. He says, that's not really the issue. He says, when I go to my boss to bring these ideas up, the first question he asks me every single time is not about, is the idea feasible? First question he asks is, whose idea is this? And so if I tell him it's my idea, I get nowhere with him. And if I tell him like it's another peer's idea, it means nothing to him. So for me to use something that you're giving me and actually change what we do, it has to, you know, it can't be just convincing, hey, Ralph had a good idea, and so, you know, we ought to go do this. Because it won't work for me. And I thought, wow, that is absolutely amazing. And I also thought, it must be very difficult to work under circumstances like that.
True. So you're saying that within this localized culture, the personality of the organization as a whole still maintained?
Yes. At least certain aspects of it.
I'm just trying to understand, how is it that a single personality can be composed of multiple cultures? Because in my understanding, at least as far as I understand what Bernard is saying, and based on what you said, is that culture should be the cause of the personality, not the other way around.
And I think that is true in many circumstances. All I'm saying, what I'm trying to convey is, culture is really not uniform. It's fragmentary. And so you can have, in organizations, you can have different cultures within different subunits of the organization, and some of them can be, in some cases, hostile. In fact, I've actually seen that where the subunit's organization was hostile to the organizational culture, which is really a bad situation and typically requires a rapid leadership change out, because, you know, you can't really function in an organization. You can't function well in an organization. And you see that in business every now and then, when because some big company has set up some big complex organization, you'll get competition within the organization that basically makes life very difficult for customers. So in the Louis Gerstner's book, Elephants Can Dance, he wrote about how IBM was about that way, where the business units were in the same country, were competing with each other and making it difficult for customers, and they were losing business as a result. So you can get this kind of fragmentary effect going on.
So as I read it, I thought this idea of organizational personality should correspond to a more general, broader level of mission or purpose of the organization.
I agree with that.
I didn't really read it as a cultural, I mean, as much as purpose, mission, and so on do fall into some subset of cultural aspects of an organization, I didn't really read it as such.
Well, my personal view is I think you can read it that way. My view is, based on my experience and how I interpret some of the words, there's an interaction between the two, right? Because if you try to create organizational mission that is counter the organizational culture, that is hugely difficult to sustain. And in many organizations, it can't be done. And so you'll see, for example, organizations that will go out of business because their culture or is one way, and this what they're trying to change the mission to just doesn't work. And one of the classic examples is Digital Equipment Corporation, that was really very skilled at making mini computers, and then because they took a lot of business away from the big mainframe computer manufacturers, and then when the personal computer came out, they were unable, because of the nature of their corporate culture, to change their mission and business goals. And they went out of business as a result. So it doesn't have to be read the way I'm reading it. I'm reading a bit more into it than is perhaps there, and it may not be correct. But I think your interpretation, Miranda, is certainly valid.
Yeah.
So one of the things I'd like to talk about, if you're ready to move on,
okay,
is about informal executive organizations.
I think we should move on to that part.
Okay. So I think it's really interesting where Bernard talks about the functions of the. He starts talking about the functions of the informal organization the informal organization, expanding the means of communication, and then I think it's a really interesting point. I think it's on 224. It's in that area. He says, so I think as Miranda said, we got to be kind of clear what he's talking about when he says informal organizations. So he says informal executive organizations. And now I'm paraphrasing, function to communicate, and then I'm quoting again, intangible facts, suggestions, suspicions that cannot pass through formal channels without raising, calling for some kind of formal action or decision, and that this informal communication process or organization makes it possible, to convey important personal influences. I just thought that was really important that Bernard acknowledges not everything can happen through the formal organization system, and that the informal communication is actually essential to have the things he calls suspicions, intangible facts. That's kind of interesting. It's a really interesting idea, an intangible fact, but okay.
Suggestions and suspicions. Suspicions attracted my attention in terms of use of words. It was quite curious. Yeah, I do agree that, I don't know, there are some parts in his entire work, and maybe it's due to this attempt to cover everything, that I find really interesting but not expanded enough or defined sufficiently to be able to say he's talking about this and therefore I can critique it. Sometimes it's a bit hazy, like it's there but it's not there. I'm not sure if you've had this feeling.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and this was one of the examples.
Absolutely.
Because I do believe that the informal side of the organization should be acknowledged, needs to be acknowledged, and plays a fundamental role. But it would also be interesting to understand the relationship between the formal and the informal side. So all of this formal communication, when it falls into the informal side, does it follow the same rules? Does it flow up? Does it flow down? Can it be managed? I don't know. I had so many questions that it would be nice to ask him.
Yeah, same here.
Not possible.
Yeah. Well, if we could get him on a panel, though, that'd be wonderful, right? So we could ask him to expand on it, because I agree with you. That was really interesting, and it had lots of implications. So I'll give you an example of what, you know, one, I think what, something that occurs to me when we talk about these intangible facts and suggestions and suspicions. So I worked in an organization where, you know, we'd had this mission and these requirements to go do something, but many people at the working level, it's the same one I told you where they wouldn't actually be, you know, they would think the plan, their view was the plan was impossible, but they wouldn't tell you that. And so the organization, that data didn't flow very well. At least I didn't get it until I learned how to work with this informal aspect of the communication. And so, but there were people at headquarters that had to know, because they were briefing other people, other organizations, about what our performance was and what we were going to get done. And they had big strategic decisions to make. So what our organization normally did was, well, okay, here's what the date is, and we're working to get that date done. And even if we were late, that's what we would keep saying. And so I happened to know this person back at headquarters and know that this was difficult for him. So he and I would start talking on the phone, and I would tell him, okay, look, here's what I personally think. This is what's going to happen. I'm not allowed to tell you this is official organizational opinion, because that only comes from the CEO. But I can tell you, this is based on the facts I know, this is what's going to happen. I'm just, you know, and I communicate the CEO, but it's his, you know, he decides what he's going to tell other people. And so my associate at headquarters, I'm communicating very informally and somewhat risky, you know, it was risky having these communications. And I told him, of course, you have to protect your source, but I said, I'm giving you this information so you can use it when you have these conversations with these other very senior people in other organizations that depend on the work that we do. And so there, I think that was sort of, but if I had said, oh yeah, you have to make, you know, here's this, if I said, we're not going to make it, then all this extra work and these formal decisions would have to happen. And it was just unworkable. And so I'm not saying it was a great aspect of the organization, but I am saying that was a way I found to try to make things work better informal.
It's interesting that he says that in these informal executive organizations, there is to be no talking of the formalities.
Yeah. Yes. Because he talks about personal influences, right? And then my last observation for the chapter kind of flows from this. And he basically, on page 227, he says, the chief functions of this informal organization are the expansion of the means of communication with reduction in the necessity for formal decisions. And so I'm like Miranda, I think, man, let's go more into that. That is really interesting. I mean, you could do lots of interesting research on that. And he doesn't go much further.
So let me chip in on what I sort of just thought of in terms of the formality, informality aspect of Bernard's writing. Kind of thinking about that in the beginning, he very explicitly, not very explicitly, but he explicitly, if you follow me.
Keep going.
Made it clear that he is following some sort of an Aristotelian worldview. And this actually came up in this chapter as well, where he said that persons without positions cannot function as executives. They mean nothing but potentiality. That's like red flags or arrows going off immediately. So, if you recall, for both Plato and Aristotle, form is it's a way in which the substance of something is molded. So the form of the organization, the formal aspect of the organization, following from this, is then these intangible aspects like personality and things like that, basically literally formed into some kind of a strategic direction, right? So the structure of the organization is its form. Then the informal organization and informal communication is simply abandoning the formal channels and the formal systems of communication. So be it the green and pink slips or emails or hierarchy, and performing activities akin to what you described when you shared a piece of information. So I think that kind of a quirky view that is only marginally present in an explicit form, but that is detectable implicitly throughout the text. I think that might help in understanding what and why Bernard says when he says about the formal and the informal, so that the formal is essentially to do with the official infrastructure of the organization, and the informal is turning phases of cooperation back into individuals who are fallible and subject to needs and wants that may not otherwise have place within the formal organization, where they are, as you recall, of course, no longer individuals.
So I think you summed it up very nicely when he talks about important personal influences, right? That if you, on the one hand, this is where I was rebelling initially, where it was, you know, you basically completely subsume yourself into the organization. And I think as Miranda was saying, you're not really an individual or a person any longer, because you're functioning as an extension of the organization. And then we have this, but this is supplemented or augmented by the informal organization, where it does incorporate impersonal political influences and the political and those kinds of things. So that's a great way to sum it up. I don't think I would have seen it that way on my own. So I think thank you for that observation.
You're most welcome.
Yes, it was very good.
And that's all for part three. Please continue on to part four to get the conclusion of our somewhat lengthy discussion of The Functions of the Executive by Chester Bernard. Thank you for listening.